Well, the Euthyphro is a very interesting text. It's part of 8 Platonic dialogues that are centered around the trial and the death of Socrates. And those dialogues are as follows. There's the Euthyphro, the Apology, the Crito, and then the Phaedo, which are the most famous 4 that are connected with the trial and death of Socrates. There are 4 other dialogues, too. The Theaetetus, the Sophist, the Statesman, and the Cratylus, which are also set in the days preceding Socrates' trial. But the Euthyphro is important because not only is it part of the scene setting for the trial and death of Socrates, but also because, like so many of these other dialogues, it constitutes in some way a response to Aristophanes' Clouds. All of these Platonic dialogues, in fact, virtually every Platonic dialogue, on some level or another, constitutes a response to Aristophanes' Clouds. Now, it doesn't necessarily respond to the Clouds by refuting the things that the Clouds says about Socrates entirely. But they at least respond to the Clouds by indicating that there's more to Socrates than the Socrates of the Clouds. And the way to handle this, I think, is just to understand that Socrates underwent a sort of philosophical development, and that the Socrates of the Clouds is, in some sense, a true representation of Socrates at one time in his life, and that the Platonic Socrates is also a true representation of Socrates at a later point in his life, and that the Platonic Socrates represents positions that are in many ways identical to the philosophical position of Aristophanes, as you can tease out from between the lines of the Clouds. And so that Socrates, when he becomes a mature thinker, is really heavily influenced by Aristophanes. But let me just raise the question, then, about the Euthyphro. What in the Euthyphro, in the dramatic situation, reminds you of things in the Clouds? How does the Euthyphro resemble the Clouds? Father beating, right? Euthyphro is beating up on his poor old father in a kind of metaphorical way. The background is this. Euthyphro's father caused the death of a man through neglect. Now, the man who died was a hired laborer who had murdered family servant or slave. And the father, the head of the household, had the criminal bound up and thrown in a ditch, and then sent somebody off to Athens to inquire about the proper course of action. But since he wasn't particularly concerned with the well-being of the murderer in the meantime, the man died of neglect and exposure in the bottom of the ditch. And the son, Euthyphro, was outraged that his father had brought about the death of this man, and so decided to prosecute him for murder. Now, this is an extraordinary act. This is even more extraordinary for the following reason. In ancient Greece, murder was not what you would call a criminal offense. It was a civil offense, meaning that if you murdered somebody, the state would not bring charges against you on behalf of the murdered victim. The only people who would bring who could bring charges against a murderer were the family members of the victims. And of course, if the victim had no family and nobody really cared about them, then you could quite easily get away with murder. Or if you murdered the whole family, again, you could quite easily get rid of murder or get away with murder because there would be nobody around to prosecute you. Now, this is a vestige of a pre-political kind of order that you find in places around the Mediterranean today. Places like Albania, for instance, where basically the social units are little clans that are extremely rivalrous and fractious. And clan loyalty is the most important form of loyalty. And they have very tenuous loyalties to anything larger than these extended family groups. And therefore, if in that sort of situation somebody kills a member of your group, it's up to the extended family to avenge them. And this pre-political notion of right and wrong was embedded within the Athenian political system. They were not that far removed from this kind of Mediterranean, highly clannish pre-political structure. The prosecution by Euthyphro of his father is an especially odd thing because it violates the whole what's considered natural order of family life, which is you take care of your own, And if somebody is in your family is murdered, well, then you prosecute them. But if a member of your family murders somebody else, especially a stranger, and especially a stranger who murders somebody close to the family, then that's a complete inversion of the proper order of things. It's proper to take care of one's own first, and not proper to be concerned about some stranger before you're concerned about your own. And so Euthyphro is doing something that seems wrong. And it's not just wrong in the moral sense, it's impious. And piety refers to, first and foremost, the respect that you owe to the divine, or to the gods. But for the Greeks, as we discussed earlier, the divine is at the root of historical traditions and institutions. And any kind of tradition or institution that has its locus in the, our origin in the times when the gods were closer to men, we're in a sense sanctified. So the state and the family were sanctified by their ancientness, because the more ancient they were, the closer they were to the gods. And therefore, there was, by extension, not only a piety towards the gods, but piety towards any institution that was founded by the gods and associated with the gods, including family. And this is why you have filial piety, or piety towards your ancestors and towards your parents, because they're older than you, and therefore they dwell closer to the gods. Euthyphro, however, finds this ridiculous, and therefore he's willing to prosecute his father for murder. And, of course, this is analogous to father beating, not respecting the old man, because he's your father. There's no more reason than that. So let's actually look at the text itself. It begins with Euthyphro saying, well, what's new, Socrates? Which indicates that he knows Socrates already. Euthyphro does know Socrates, and he knows a number of things about Socrates, his character and his reputation. First of all, he knows where he usually hangs out, at the Lyceum, and he doesn't hang out usually at the porch of the king or the stoa of the king, which is a public building, kind of covered walkway, where the king Archon in Athens, who was the person who presided over legal proceedings having to do with piety, held court. Socrates says, surely you don't also happen to have some lawsuit before the king as I do, Socrates. He has a sense that Socrates is not the kind of guy who would be involved with something political or legal. Again, it indicates he has some knowledge of Socrates' character, at least some opinion about Socrates' character. And Socrates says, well, they don't call it a lawsuit, they call it an indictment. And an indictment is something that's handed down by the state for crimes against the state. And piety, which for us is an entirely private issue, right, was for the Greeks a very public issue. The state wouldn't prosecute you for murder, but they would prosecute you for being impious. Why? Because religion was largely civil religion for the ancient Greeks. And that meant that religious education was central to the education that the polis took responsibility for, the city-state took responsibility for. And a person who somehow undermined the religious education was considered to be a traitor, in some sense. The gods were there to protect the city, and religious rituals were instituted to make sure that the gods continued to protect the city. And if you got in the way of that, it would be like, you know, getting in the way of any other government policy. Now, the Greeks were not particularly concerned with your opinions, necessarily, about the gods. Concerned with the right opinion is called orthodoxy, literally. Right opinions, what orthos and doxa means. But they were concerned with what's called orthopraxy, having the right practice. And that meant that you were considered a good and pious person if you went along with the publicly instituted rituals that the city had. As long as you went along with these things and took part in them, you were considered a pious citizen, and you were keeping up your end of your civic duties in the religious sphere. Xenophon, when he talks about Socrates, says that Socrates was extremely punctilious, extremely scrupulous about maintaining all the proper public respects due to the gods. And on those grounds alone, he should not have been convictable of impiety. because that's the main concern. But what Socrates is really being accused of is something more than just not keeping up with the rituals. He's being accused of bringing in new gods and undermining belief in the old gods. And this has to do with opinion. And because he's accused of bringing in new gods and undermining belief in the old gods, he's being accused of corrupting the youth. Now, Euthyphro at the bottom of page 41 says, it's an indictment. What are you saying? Someone, as is likely, has brought an indictment against you, Socrates, for I won't charge you with doing so against another. Again, he thinks he knows that Socrates would never do wrong to another person, although he could be wronged by others. And this, of course, is a Socratic principle that's defended in the Gorgias, that it's always better to suffer wrong than to do it. At the top of page 43, he also indicates that he knows all about Socrates' daimonion. Okay, so again, there's familiarity with Socrates. So Socrates explains why he's in trouble. This young fellow named Meletus has brought an indictment against him on charges of impiety. He says at the bottom of 42 that he's a maker of gods. Okay, he makes new gods and don't believe in the ancient ones, and that by doing that he ends up corrupting the youth of the city. And the description of Meletus is fairly detailed and interesting on page 42. He's near the top. He says, he's got long, straight hair. He's not quite full-bearded. He has a hooked nose. And all of these characteristics would be meaningful to the Greeks, who had strong beliefs in physiognomy, which means that the idea that you can read people's character from their appearances. And
aristocracy?
Well, hooked nose was a sign of a vexatious and nasty nature. Just think of birds of prey.
Okay.
So, a hooked nose would have that connotation. Not quite full bearded indicates that he's somewhat effeminate in the views of the Greeks. And long, straight hair, well, long hair was kind of foppish. So if he had wore his hair long, he would be considered a fop.
Okay,
fashionable. because you looked at me. So he would be somewhat foppish, effeminate, and having a vexatious and quarrelsome nature. This is the characteristic. But Socrates is very interesting at the center of the page, too, because he claims that what Meletus is accusing him of is no ignoble thing. The accusation is not ignoble in itself. Socrates really does believe that you have to take care of the young. You have to oversee carefully the education of the young. So at the very center of page 42, it says, he alone of the politicians appears to me to begin correctly, for it is correct to take care of the young first so that they will be the best possible, just as a good farmer properly takes care of the young plants first, and after this, the others as well. And so Meletus is perhaps first cleaning us out, the corruptors of the young sprouts, as he asserts. Then after this, it is clear that when he has taken care of the older ones, he will become the cause of the most and the greatest good things for the city. At least that is the likely outcome for someone beginning from such a beginning. Now, there's a little bit of irony there. I don't think he really believes that Meletus's intentions are all that good. But there is an indication that Socrates fundamentally agrees in principle with the idea that you should be very concerned about the upbringing of the young, and you should clean out the corruptors. His real quarrel is not with cleaning out corruptors so much as the accusation that he's one of the corruptors of the youth. Okay, that's where Socrates' real concern is. And this, again, is an indication that Socrates is willing to make knowledge claims about things like education. And here, he's making a claim, saying it is good to be concerned with rearing the young right from the very beginning. And every time you find a knowledge claim in Socrates, it has something to do with education or the nature of the soul. And the connection is, of course, that education properly done is the cultivation of care of the soul. And again, Socrates knows a lot when you actually look at the knowledge claims he makes, but they are always claims about the soul and its proper tendons. So anyway, let's continue.
Another next phrase for the soul.
Yeah, the erotic ones. So in the Theages, he says that he's stupendously knowledgeable about erotic things, and that refers to the nature of the soul. And in the Theages, recall that he identifies his daimonion with his knowledge of erotic things. So the daimonion and its utterances or deliverances is a way of personifying Socrates' knowledge of the human soul. So anyway, Euthyphro thinks that he knows immediately what Socrates means when he says that he's been accused of being a corrupter of the youth, or a maker of gods. And he says at the top of 43, I understand, Socrates, it's because you assert that the daimonion comes to you on occasion. So he has brought this indictment, claiming that you are making innovations concerning the divine things. Now for the Greeks and the Romans, and I forget the exact word, the exact verbs, but making innovation is the verbs for making innovations are the same as the verb for treason. And this is an indication of the incredibly conservative nature of all traditional societies. Any kind of innovation, especially concerning divine things, is equivalent to treason. And this is why it's a matter of concern for the state. Euthyphro goes on and says, well, you know, he's obviously going to slander you in court before the many. And then he says, I'm in the same boat, Socrates, and me too. Whenever I say something in the assembly concerning the divine things, predicting for them what will be, they laugh at me as if I were mad. And yet of the things I have foretold, I have spoken nothing that is not true. Nevertheless, they envy us all who are of this sort. But one should not give any thought to them, but should confront them. So Euthyphro claims also to have the power to predict the future and to know divine things. Euthyphro is what you would call a diviner. A soothsayer. He claims to be able to know the future. He also claims to know what the gods want and what the gods are about. And in the Cratylus, which is one of the dialogues associated with the trial and death of Socrates, Euthyphro is mentioned there too. And the term that's used to describe him is, the Greek is enthusiasmus, okay, an enthusiast. And what's an enthusiast? Well, an enthusiast is a person who claims to know the divine. And in English, the term enthusiasm, say, in the 18th century, if one used that term, one would always use it to refer to claims of knowledge about divine things. A religious enthusiast was a person who claimed to know the will of God. Okay. And so Euthyphro is an enthusiast and a soothsayer or diviner. This is his profession and his claim to fame, as he puts it. He thinks that this is an enviable thing. He does think of himself as better than the rest of human beings. He says so.
So it doesn't seem like he was taken very seriously, but was that a position that was taken seriously from anyone?
Well, you know, you read histories from the time, and before every important decision, people would always consult a diviner, a soothsayer. Yeah, Nancy Reagan did. I mean,
an oracle.
Yeah, but sometimes they would get a soothsayer to come in and read the entrails of a sheep or something like that was slaughtered. They were always looking for omens and auspices to make sure that they would act in the proper way at the proper time.
So
he could have been taken very seriously. He clearly didn't maintain have any public office. And somebody who was in charge of taking auspices, as they were called, you know, was given that as a public office. Sometimes they were chosen by lot to look at bird entrails or things like that. But other times they'd call in experts to do it. But apparently, you know, Euthyphro wasn't taken particularly seriously in this regard. But he did try and make his opinions known. Or maybe the things that he recommended were not the kinds of things that they wanted to hear. But, sure. Yeah.
It seems as if the names have meaning.
Right.
And are these people that were real, or are these characters that were made up to illustrate the point?
Well, you see, the trouble is that we can't entirely be sure. Now, there was someone named Theages, and there was a fellow, and his father was named Demodocus, right? We do know this from historical fact. However, these particular historical characters might not have done the things that Plato represents them as doing, and the reason why he might have chosen them is because their names would have been significant for the roles that they're cast in the dialogues to play. However, with Euthyphro, we don't know of any historical Euthyphro outside of Plato. So in this case, he could be an entirely fictional character, but his name means straight thinker. Euthyphron means straight thinker. And there is something to that name. Well, to put it this way, there's something appropriate about that name when you look at his character. Although his thinking goes in a circle when he argues, there's something kind of clumsily earnest about the way he goes about thinking. Euthyphro, if you try and penetrate his character, you'd have to say that he's extremely vain. But he says, you know, if I didn't know divine things exactly, then there'd be nothing that sets me apart from all the rest of humanity. But he clearly thinks that he does know this, and therefore that he is set apart, which means that he thinks he's better than any other diviner, for one thing, and better than the rest of humanity in general. He is arrogant as well. And there is what's extraordinary about him is that his piety is really the grossest form of impiety. Because when he tries to justify his actions, what does he do? And there's something that he does when he justifies beating his father up in court that's exactly like something that the unjust speech does in the clouds. The gods did it, right, exactly. Zeus bound his father for gulping down his sons, and Zeus's father castrated his father before him. And so, because the gods beat up their fathers, so should I. That's his view. Now, that's not piety in any conventional sense at all. But, of course, he claims to know better than convention what piety is. And this is why he's willing to flout the conventional notion of piety that you never prosecute your father, because he knows better. And so this is another aspect of him. He claims to have knowledge of the gods, not just opinion or likely stories, but he claims to know precisely what they want, which is an extraordinary bit of hubris. And his knowledge of the gods leads him to imitate the gods, not to do as they say, but to do as they do. So there's something extraordinarily vain and hubristic about him. He's a kind of enthusiast and a kind of fundamentalist, if you want to say that. And you could say he's a straight thinker in this sense. He's not a very subtle thinker. And so when he looks at what the gods do, he thinks, well, I should do the same. And he doesn't grasp the subtlety that, well, maybe the gods get to do things differently because they're gods. That's a more subtle thought. And in that sense, Euthyphro is just as clueless as the just speech in the clouds, right, who doesn't know how to defend piety once it's pointed out that the gods do bad things. There's something kind of clumsy about his thinking. But isn't that the case with a lot of sort of fundamentalist types, right? They claim, on the one hand, that it's all so easy to know what the gods believe. You just have to read what the book says, right? But in reading what the book says, which seems so straightforward and usually is done rather unsubtly, they end up elevating themselves above everybody else and becoming very hubristic. Huh? Yeah, hubristic, condescending, arrogant. And this is all wrapped up in Euthyphro. He's very much this way. So anyway, Euthyphro says, well, Socrates, they're just envious of you, but, we should pay no heed to these people. We should just go and confront them. And Socrates, on 43, responds, my dear Euthyphro, being laughed at is perhaps no matter. For in fact, the Athenians, as it seems to me, do not much care about someone whom they suppose to be clever, unless he is a skillful teacher of his own wisdom. But their spiritedness is aroused against anyone who, they say, or who they suppose makes others like himself, either from envy, as you say, or because of something else. And this because of something else is really interesting. He never says what it is. But what could it be? Yes, you know, the Athenians might get angry at skillful teachers because of envy, but they might have other reasons as well. What the something else is, again, is the sense that, well, corrupting the youth, exactly. They're not just envious, they're also being protective of the young ones, which he thinks is a good thing. And so he's not so willing as Euthyphro to dismiss the charges or the seriousness of this. Right? He really thinks that there is a serious issue behind this. He doesn't think it's just when pointed at him, when directed at him. These charges are not just against Socrates, but they are a serious concern, and they can't be just swept aside like Euthyphro does as mere envy. And then he continues. Euthyphro goes on, "That's why I do not at all desire to try out how they are disposed toward me in this regard." Euthyphro doesn't want to know what the masses think of him. You know, he says that they laugh at him, but he doesn't want to know what they would really do, which means that although he does show up to the assembly occasionally, he doesn't do it very often, apparently, and he's not very eager to try their patience. Euthyphro is prudent about this. But Socrates says as follows, "Perhaps you seem to make yourself available only infrequently and not to be willing to teach your own wisdom." That's why they're not mad at Euthyphro, because he doesn't show up very frequently. "But I fear that I, because of my philanthropy, seem to them to say profusely whatever I possess to every man, not only without pay, but even paying with pleasure if anyone is willing to listen to me." Socrates had a reputation of going around always in the open and saying whatever he thought. He seemed to be doing that. Of course, the fact that he seemed to be doing that could be deceiving. There could be many things that Socrates is refusing to say. But, of course, if somebody's being prudently silent about something, you don't really know that unless you're very, very careful at listening. But so to the untutored ear, Socrates seems like a profuse blabbermouth. But the fact is he might be quite reticent when you get right down to it about important things. But he's got a reputation of going around and saying things profusely to anyone who will listen. "So if, as I was saying just now, they were going to laugh at me, as you say they do at you, it would not be unpleasant to pass the time in the law court joking and laughing. But if they're going to be serious, then how this will turn out is unclear except to you diviners." So Socrates, you know, confirming here that Euthyphro sees himself as a diviner. That's his reputation. Now, I think this is a really kind of pregnant passage, and maybe I'll just unravel it in a way that's entirely arbitrary or read too much out of it. But I really see any reference to laughter or looking silly in Plato, well, as in some way a reference back to the clouds. And here, I think that this is what's going on. Socrates is saying that if the men in the court are the kind who can laugh, then it'll be a pleasant trial, which means that he'll win. Okay. He'll enjoy himself. But if they're serious, and he's not sure what the outcome will be. And the reason is this. Socrates is going to go to that trial, and he's going to do what he's been doing for years. He's going to make fools out of these people. And there are two reactions that you can have when somebody makes a fool out of you. If you can laugh at yourself and see that you really are foolish, that's a sign that you can take a step back from yourself and see yourself as you are, and get beyond the humiliation. And you can even learn something about yourself that way. And that is, I think, what happened with Socrates and Aristophanes. Aristophanes made a fool out of Socrates in the clouds. But Socrates is the kind of person who can laugh at his own folly. And because he can laugh at his own folly, he can learn from it and go beyond it. And so in Plato's Symposium, which is set 8 years after the premiere of the clouds, Socrates and Aristophanes are shown getting on quite well together. They're shown as friends. And that's an indication that being made a fool of by Aristophanes was not something that would prevent Socrates from becoming his friend. want? Well, he was indebted to it in some sense. Because if somebody can make a fool out of you, and you really are a fool, that's really a good thing for them to do. Why? Because folly is bad, and you want to get rid of it as much as possible. And, you know, if somebody shows you to be a fool, you should thank them and become their friend. Of course, it's tough love, but it's hard to live down. And serious people, people who can't laugh at themselves, never learn the lesson. Instead, they just get angry at the person who tries to benefit them by showing up their own folly, and they begin to resent that person. And of course, Socrates earned the resentment of quite a number of people. And Anytus, who was one of the people who brought charges against Socrates, who actually was one of the people who put Meletus up to this, is shown in Plato's dialogue, the Meno, being worsted by Socrates. And he's not the kind of guy who could laugh at himself, and so he became Socrates' enemy. And Socrates will tell you in the Apology that he made lots of enemies this way. And so what he's really saying is this: if he goes to the law court and the people in the jury are the kind of people who can be made fools of by him, but be benefited by it because they can laugh along with him, then they'll become his friends and things will turn out okay. But if they're serious men who can't laugh at their own folly, then they're never going to get beyond their own folly. They're going to continue behaving foolishly, and they're going to end up hating Socrates for trying to benefit them. Okay, and he speaks of his philanthropy, of his love of mankind, right? And this is what's led him to have this reputation for being a blabbermouth. Well, you know, we have to understand what he means by calling his characteristic philosophical activities philanthropic. What he's saying is that his modus operandi is to go around to people who are reputed to be wise and make fools out of them. And this, he claims, is philanthropic. Well, it is philanthropic if a person can become wise through learning to laugh at their own folly. And I think this is very clearly something that Plato himself believed. And the reason why we know this is that the Platonic dialogues are comic. The Euthyphro is a comedy. It's a dry kind of comedy. There's no question about it. The Phaeaces that we looked at last week is a comedy. All of Plato's dialogues are comic. Even the death of Socrates is treated comically. And that's a tribute to Aristophanes. And it's a tribute to the role of laughing at folly in the pursuit of wisdom. So Euthyphro then explains his lawsuit and explains how his family is indignant. And Socrates says, at the center of page 45, but before Zeus, he says, and Zeus, of course, is the patron of the family, the patron god of fathers and so forth. Before Zeus, do you, Euthyphro, suppose that you have such precise knowledge about how the divine things are disposed, and the pious and impious things, that assuming that these things were done just as you say, you don't fear that by pursuing a lawsuit against your father, you in turn may happen to be doing an impious act? And Euthyphro says, no, there would be no benefit for me, Socrates, nor would Euthyphro be any different from the many human beings if I didn't know all such things precisely. This is his hubris coming out. He knows better than everybody else. And his claim to fame is that he knows more precisely than anybody else the divine things and what's pious. And so Socrates says, well, Euthyphro, in that case, I should become your student. Because I'm being charged with impiety, and you know better than anybody else what piety is. So if you can teach me what piety is, then I can march into that law court and I can show Meletus that he's wrong to think that I'm pious. So teach me, Euthyphro. Teach me what piety is, so that I might better myself and get out of this lawsuit. And Euthyphro, of course, is flattered by this. He doesn't apparently catch, I think, the sarcasm here, the irony, because I don't think for a minute Socrates believes that Euthyphro knows what he thinks he knows and is really wise about divine things. You have to hear the sarcasm here, I think, the magnanimous dissimulation. He's talking down to Euthyphro. He's flattering him at the same time. Euthyphro, he thinks, is a prize fool. What's that? I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me be your student. But really what that's... Yeah. And what he's really going to do is he's going to teach Euthyphro a lesson. And what's Socrates' purpose in doing this? Well, by the end of the dialogue, you get a clue. And it seems to be his purpose is to try and show Euthyphro that he doesn't know what piety is any better than anybody else. And therefore, that he'd be better off being very careful about pursuing a suit against his father, lest he be genuinely angering the gods, because he doesn't know what the gods want any better than common opinion. And therefore, the implication is that maybe you should just follow the customary views about the gods, Euthyphro. And so what Socrates ends up doing is he ends up defending the father against the son. He ends up taking a father beater and moderating him, okay, which is exactly the opposite of what the Socrates of the clouds does with Pheidippides and Strepsiades. And this is how it's a response to the clouds. Socrates is taking a father beater and making him a better son in the Euthyphro. Euthyphro says, well, sure, Socrates, I'll be your teacher. And so Socrates on page 46 says about the center of the text on 46, the main text of 46. So tell me now before Zeus, again, it's Zeus, what you just now strongly affirm that you know plainly. What sort of things do you say the pious and the impious are concerning murder and concerning other things? Or isn't the pious itself the same as itself in every action? And again, isn't the impious opposite to everything pious? Well, it itself is similar to itself and has one certain idea in accordance with impiety. Everything that is going to be impious. Now that's a mouthful. But what he's talking about here is this notion of the ideas or the forms. We don't have to say too much because there's not too much said about it in the dialogue. But basically, it's this. It's a kind of model pattern, the Greek paradigm. And it functions like this. Say that you want to identify certain acts as pious. And you can all say these are pious acts. So honoring your father and mother is a pious act. Attending the religious festivals is a pious act. Not taking the God's name in vain is a pious act, right? And so you can name all these pious acts, but then Socrates is going to ask you, okay, well, what about these acts is pious? Can you isolate from these particular pious acts what their piety consists in? And what that will be is a kind of idea or form of piety, which is a kind of model of piety that you can look to. And what he wants to do is he wants to separate what's pious off from each of these particular acts, this one form of piety that they all have in common, and he wants to examine it and get an account of it. And so he says, there's one idea of piety, as he puts it. He says, isn't the pious itself the same as itself in every action? Meaning, isn't what makes each pious act pious the same, you know, in each pious act? And if we can separate this idea or form of piety off and give an account of it and define it, then we know what piety as such is. So he's trying to, in a sense, give an abstract definition or account of what piety is. Now, in other Platonic dialogues, these forms or ideas are given a much more developed metaphysical status. But for our purposes here, what it really is basically a kind of definition of what piety is, such that if you have this definition, you can go into the realm of human affairs, and using this definition, you can pick out the pious and the impious acts and sort them one from another. So that's what he's looking for. It's a general account of what piety is in itself, as opposed to particular acts of piety.
So not just showing Euthyphro that you can't define it, but it's not necessary to define it?
Well, it is necessary. Well, put it this way. There's something that some people have named the Socratic fallacy. And the Socratic fallacy is the view that unless you can define something in an abstract sense, you don't really know what it is. Now, that is something of a fallacy when you get right down to it, because That would imply, first of all, that four human beings became reflective enough to start defining their terms, that they never knew what they were talking about. But clearly we have to know something of what we're talking about if we're ever going to get as far as defining our terms, because the terms wouldn't mean anything. I mean, we wouldn't have any terms there, really, to start defining. So there is something suspicious about the idea that you don't know things unless you can give an abstract definition of them. I don't think that Socrates believed in the Socratic fallacy. Because when you see him using this sort of approach, well, Euthyphro, if you can't tell me what piety is, then you don't really know what it is. You find him using this as a kind of club with people for a particular educational purpose. Okay? In this case, he's trying to talk Euthyphro out of this notion that he has, that he knows better than anybody else what piety is. And so my sense is that it's a kind of false premise that Socrates has insinuated in the argument, and that he's going to use this as sort of a lever to move Euthyphro away from his persecution of his father. That's generally the context where you find the so-called Socratic fallacy being used. It's being used by Socrates to, in a sense, wrestle somebody into submission and to force them to return from the idea that they have some kind of special knowledge or precise or scientific knowledge of something to common opinion. No, it doesn't mean that there isn't a definition. Yeah, and I will argue that a definition of piety is given here, yet that Euthyphro never catches what it is. But he actually blurts it out, but he doesn't understand that he really has defined piety, which is interesting. I'll show you where that is. But it is possible, I think, to have definitions of things for Plato. And I think Socrates believed that too. I don't think they believe that you don't know something if you can't define it, though. And maybe the point would be something like this. We all have a kind of tacit or unarticulated knowledge of how to use words. And we pick this up like, you know, we pick up the words themselves. And the way that Socrates puts it is this. He says we already know the forms of things, the ideas. We know what the form of piety is. And in the Meno and in the Phaedo, he gives a myth about how we saw the forms before we had bodies, when our souls were floating around in the netherworld. We caught glimpses of the forms. So this is also in the Phaedrus. And then the soul falls into the embodied realm and it goes through this birth trauma and forgets everything. And that what dialectic is a process of remembering the knowledge that we've forgotten. But the point is that even though we've forgotten how to define piety on this account, we can still find pious acts. Because although we don't have articulate, explicit knowledge of piety, we have a kind of inarticulate, implicit knowledge of piety. And that allows us to pick out pious things. Now, a more naturalistic explanation of how we have this knowledge is you can just give through theory of language acquisition. How do we learn how to apply words? Well, we see them being applied by our parents, and we try and apply them, and if we make mistakes, our parents correct them. And eventually we get the point, we catch on, right? We see what's essential about, say, a dog versus a cat. I distinctly remember when I was a child learning the proper uses of certain words. And you learn it by trial and error. You get corrected, you know, when you make mistakes. So at first, you know, any four-legged furry thing is a dog, if that's the first thing you encounter. And if you call every four-legged furry thing a dog, your mother says, no, that's a giraffe, or that's a cat. And you start looking, you know, wondering, well, what's the difference? And you start seeing differences. And I remember distinctly when I could see that tigers were cats, too. They were big cats. There was some cat-like quality that they have. And you can see what's identical between a big tiger and a little house cat, eventually, if you focus your mind on that. Okay, and that kind of language learning process is kind of interesting because but what happens is you get the idea of cathood eventually. And from then on, whenever you encounter a new cat, you can pretty much say, ah, it's another kind of cat. Even weird-looking, hairless cats, they still look cat-like. Weird-looking, hairless little dogs, you can say, oh, this is a weird-looking little dog, but you still know it's a dog. And so we do have the capacity to know the forms of things, even though we might not be fully able to articulate what a definition of a dog is. And can we really define a dog? Well, we can give a genus and a species, but that's really not giving a definition. That's just it's much more abstract, but we start out with concrete things and we learn abstractions. We learn how to apply abstractions like honesty or decency or kindness or charm eventually. Yeah, we learn by seeing examples and then wondering, well, what does this example have in common with the one we had before? We get paradigms in our mind, models, right? And the first dog you see becomes a model. And you learn eventually to extend that paradigm, or it becomes transformed with every new dog you see. Every new breed of dog slightly expands it and transforms it. Whenever I listen to a piece of music for the first time, that first performance becomes the paradigm for me. And I'll hear every new performance of it against that background. But then, as soon as I hear a new performance or see a new slant on it, my idea of what that piece of music is becomes enriched and transformed. And each new experience transforms your idea in some of something in some subtle ways. What dialectic is for Plato is a process of gradually making articulate what's inarticulate or implicit. It's making explicit what's implicit. But the point is that even with inarticulated, implicit knowledge, you can still know. It's still knowledge because it allows you to sort things out into the proper kind. A little kid can go into an animal shelter and sort the dogs and the cats from one another, but if you ask them why or how they do it, they're at a loss. So we do know, even though we can't say. However, Socrates uses this assumption, which is questionable, that we don't know if we can't say, to try and really strong-arm Euthyphro into the conclusion that he doesn't know. And that forces him back to common opinion, or the traditional view of piety, which is a good thing for him to believe. Now, this is, again, quite opposite the Socrates of the Clouds, who tears down traditional opinions and tries to erect philosophical substitutes, or doesn't try to erect some substitutes for the gods or morality, for that matter. Euthyphro is being brought back to common opinion here.